Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Arnie Gundersen, an energy advisor with Fairwinds Associates, a company who provide research, analysis and paralegal services around environmental and energy issues. An independent nuclear engineering and safety expert, Arnie provides testimony on nuclear operations, reliability, safety and radiation issues to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, congressional and state legislatures, and governmental agencies and officials throughout the US, Canada, and internationally. He has been a leading voice globally about the impact of Fukushima nuclear disaster, and he joins me now. Arnie Gundersen, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Hi, Helen. How are you?
Yeah, very well, Arnie. It's at least 2 months since we've spoken, and your show, your interviews are always the most popular interviews on If You Love This Planet because people are hungry for information about all things nuclear, but particularly about Fukushima and Japan. So now you just said to me that we have a country with absolutely no nuclear reactors at all. Would you like to tell us where Japan is at the moment, and then specifically we will hone down on the latest developments of Fukushima and what is happening there. So would you like to talk about Japan in general at the moment?
Yes. Well, you know, May 6th was the last day that any nuclear power plant is operating in Japan. And it's the first time in five decades when a nuclear plant has not been running. They've had at least one nuclear reactor running every moment of the day for the last five decades until May 6th. There's 54 nuclear power plants in Japan. Probably 10 will never start up again as a result of the tsunami or as a result of being built on an earthquake fault. But still, 54 nuclear plants are shut down, representing 35% of the nation's generation capacity.
Well, I know that there's an enlarging anti-nuclear movement now in Japan, particularly amongst the women who in the past haven't been truly represented in government or local government or elsewhere, but the women are getting really angry. Do you think there's a rising anti-nuclear feeling in Japan that could, in fact, block any of the reactors from starting up again, Arnie?
Well, I have noticed exactly what you say. There seems to be a gender split in Japan. The men are more willing to believe what the government tells them, and women, probably because they, you know, are also mothers, are concerned about the long-term viability of their kids, and there's definitely a split. It's really significant because this is a culture which normally marches lockstep with the government. There was a report 2 weeks ago. There was an American reporter at a community event where the people were questioning their leaders, and the people were screaming at their leaders. And the American reporter was next to a Japanese reporter, and the Japanese man turned to him and he said, "I can't believe I'm in Japan." So, you know, this has been a dramatic cultural change in men and women, but especially in women. There's a term called the Fukushima divorce, which has just entered the lexicon over there. So many women are concerned about their children's health that that they're leaving, even if their husbands decide to stay. So it's really dramatic. And considering what the culture used to be like and how quickly it occurred, less than a year, it doesn't bode well politically for the parties that presently are in control.
Now, Arnie Gundersen, I want you to give us an update of where the Fukushima reactors now stand, both from the three meltdowns in units 1, 2, and 3, building 4, the collective spent fuel pool, all the other spent fuel pools, and where things stand. So the time is yours now, Arnie.
Well, let's go in reverse order this time. We used to do 1, 2, 3, 4. We'll do 4, 3, 2, 1. Blast off. the fourth unit is presently getting a lot of international attention as a result of two Japanese ambassadors. I have been concerned about the fourth unit since the very first week of the accident.
Yes, I remember that.
The Regulatory Commission.
Yep.
Yeah, that fourth unit was the one that didn't blow up from nuclear fuel in the core, but it blew up with nuclear fuel in the fuel pool, and so we've got an enormous amount of highly radioactive fuel sitting essentially in a swimming pool with no roof over it. The concern is that the building has been structurally damaged from fire and from an explosion in the building next to it and from its own explosion. And so it's weakened. If anyone is concerned and believes in the power of prayer, I mean, this is one to pray. We don't want an earthquake over there, because I think about a 7 or a 7.5 will knock that building to the ground. And the concern with that is that you've got nuclear fuel that's not in a containment, and it can burn in air. It's still hot enough that it can begin to burn. And, well, you know the drill about the cesium and plutonium and all that, but it would volatilize as the fuel burns, and it creates a pyrophoric fire, which is a fire that water cannot put out. Likely resulting in an evacuation of Tokyo at least, and potentially contamination of the whole northern hemisphere. So it's if we don't have an earthquake, we can all breathe a sigh of relief. But it's critically important to get the fuel out of that reactor just as quick as possible. So the Japanese ambassadors have been lobbying internationally to make sure that Tokyo Electric and the Japanese government spend enough money quickly enough to remove that fuel. That's an international concern, and we got to jump on it, because if it goes 5 years, earthquakes don't wait, but we have the opportunity to empty the fuel as quick as possible. So, Unit 3, on
well,
the
wait
other
a minute.
Hand,
wait a minute. Let's just finish Unit 4. I don't know how they can empty the pool when the crane that moves the spent fuel rods has been seriously damaged. How are they going to get that spent fuel out of the pool, Arnie?
Ah, that's a great question. I'm going to make you an engineer here. You keep asking questions.
Yeah, I'm an
like
engineer
that.
By, yeah, right.
You're right. The crane, there's two cranes. There's that green crane, which is pretty evident in a lot of the pictures, and then a larger crane designed to handle the fuel casks. And they're both too damaged to use. So the first thing they're doing is they are dismantling the building block by block. And you can see, if you look at the pictures over the last 3 or 4 months, the building is changing. But it's not because it's falling apart, although it is on the verge of falling apart. It's because a large crane is pulling out all of these major components. But then they've got to build a building over top of the building that's there. And this is something I said they should do on a radio show here in the U.S. a year ago. And Tokyo Electric has finally come out with basically the same plan. So timeliness is critical. So they'll build a building over the top of this of the destroyed building. It won't make the Unit 4 building any stronger, but it will be strong enough in and of itself to carry the heavy crane that can lift the nuclear fuel canisters out.
Oh,
yeah.
I see.
So that's and that's not even started yet, Helen. So, you know, to build a building that's substantial is, you know, potentially a couple of years and then a couple more years to move the fuel. I think we're looking at 3 to 5 years before we get that fuel out of there.
Well, that's too long, really, isn't it? What sort of energy and money and international cooperation is going into this project, Arnie?
Well, right now there's none.
Really?
Right. The Japanese government and Tokyo Electric are controlling everything. You know, it might mean that there are international companies involved, but they're being paid for by Tokyo Electric and the Japanese government. But there's no international effort. You know, that the European experts or the American experts are not unilaterally giving up of their time to offer solutions or to expedite the process. It's just being handled like a construction project, and that's unfortunate, to say the least.
Well, but my understanding is that international governments and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the U.S., and I'm sure the Europeans, know that if Building 4 goes and collapses, that it could mean quite severe contamination of the Northern Hemisphere. Why isn't there a sense of urgency about this, Arnie Gundersen?
Well, I think it shines the light on the fuel pool problem in general, especially in the U.S. And none of the U.S. utilities want to admit that their reactor fuel pools are as full of nuclear material, and in many cases much more full of nuclear material than Fukushima. So the constituencies here in the States don't want to draw attention to the nuclear fuel problem at Fukushima, because, you know, you point one finger at someone and you've got three pointing right back at you, and they just don't want to bring attention to the fact that American fuel pools are not a whole heck of a lot better.
Well, is that because the utilities in America running the reactors, in fact, control the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, so therefore it's not an independent agency able to exert its authority internationally. Is that correct?
Yes, that's absolutely true. The every single commissioner on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has been approved by the trade organization, NEI, has been approved and vetted through Congress by NEI for the last 20 years. So we've had, every year a new commissioner who's supported by the nuclear industry gets approved to regulate the nuclear industry. But to expand on how bad the problem is, let's look at Pilgrim, which is right near your son's house in Boston. There's 37 years of nuclear fuel in the fuel pool at the Pilgrim plant. There's only 8 or 9 years of fuel in the pool at Fukushima. So effectively, the Pilgrim plant has 4 times more nuclear material sitting in the same kind of fuel pool without a containment over it as they do at Fukushima. And what's keeping it there is money. It's simple to remove the nuclear fuel from those pools. You put it in dry casks, and you store it on the ground away from the fuel pool. But it costs about $2 million per cask, and nobody wants to spend the $100 million to empty the pool. I think the biggest concern in the United States is that by calling attention to Fukushima, we also call attention to ourselves.
Oh, my God. So I wonder how many, we know that Senator Wyden from Oregon went to look at Fukushima and got a hell of a shock and came back and wrote quite strong letters to the NRC and indeed to the president, saying something must be done. But you are really implying that his letter was not taken seriously, Arnie Gundersen?
I think that's true. I think that, I was just testifying 5 days ago at the NRC on hardened vents. Even though the hardened vents failed at Fukushima, the nuclear industry is trying to keep the 23 reactors that are identical to Fukushima operating in the U.S. So they're the same hardened vents they're now calling reliable hardened vents. So if we call the things that broke three times and caused three explosions reliable, somehow or other the problem goes away. And all of the Fukushima changes that, 30 years ago when Peter Bradford and others were running the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would have been implemented. Now we run the gauntlet with technical people who know that even if they have a concern, when it goes up to the commission for a final vote, they're likely to get overruled because the commission is focused more on running these reactors and making money than they are about public health and safety.
This just makes my stomach curdle, you know, when you think of what could happen if Unit 4 collapses to the United States itself, let alone Canada and the whole of the Northern Hemisphere. Do you feel the same way, Arnie?
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, I've always been frustrated with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's slow response, but one would have thought that watching three nuclear reactors blow themselves to smithereens would change the mentality. And in fact, it hasn't. You know, there's definitely a pervasive attitude in the nuclear industry here in the States that it can't happen here. And I also think, you know, the same thing holds for Europe and Asia. Mm-hmm. We all think that what happened to Fukushima is unique, and the lesson is strictly a Japanese lesson. And I don't believe that's true.
Okay, so to get on to the Building 4 again and the spent fuel pool, how are they keeping it cool, Arnie? Are they continually pouring seawater into the spent fuel pool on top of Building 4? Is that how they're keeping it cool?
Well, they have a jury-rigged cooling system set up. It's not seismically qualified, but as long as there's no earthquake, it will cool the plant. So they're pulling water out, running it through a heat exchanger, and pumping it back in.
Oh,
so
I see.
They're not making the problem any worse with the jury-rigged cooling system. Now, you'll recall in winter at Fukushima, several times the cooling system froze and broke. But now it seems to, now summer's here and it seems to be getting by. But all bets are off.
Yeah.
All bets are off if there's an earthquake.
And the pipes are made of plastic, aren't they? That's very, very jury-rigged. So let's get on to Building 3 now that you were going to address, Arnie Gundersen.
This is the sleeper, as far as I'm concerned. Unit 3 has about half the nuclear fuel in its pool that Unit 4 does, but some of it is still quite hot. It had been removed about 6 months before the meltdowns.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a hot enough quarter of a core that it could burn in air. And, of course, the Unit 3 building is fatally flawed. So my concern is as much the same problem on Unit 4 could occur on Unit 3. We seem to just worry about Unit 4, but the pool at Unit 3 isn't much different. Of course, Unit 3 is compounded by the fact that you have a meltdown inside the nuclear reactor, and a melt through where some of that contamination has left the nuclear reactor and is on the floor of the containment building. I don't think we've got a China syndrome kind of a meltdown into the earth, but clearly we have nuclear material lying on the floor of the containment building, and that's not much different because the contamination from the water that's lying directly on the nuclear fuel this leaking out of the containment penetrations. Turns out all of the wires that go in and out of the containment to run the to measure the reactor and to run the pumps and to run the safety systems, all of those go through penetrations which, because of the temperature and because of the salt water, have failed. So we're finding in these containments it's impossible to fill them with water because they leak almost as if, you know, somebody has taken a shotgun to a soda bottle. It's got a lot of holes in it now. So the water they pump into Unit 3's reactor is running out the bottom of the reactor and leaking through the floor, one, into the groundwater, and two, into surrounding buildings. That piece is true for all the reactors, 1, 2, and 3. So we can just put a ditto on that one for the other reactors. But the difference is that the explosive force on Unit 3 was much greater.
Oh.
There's one picture of an equipment hatch. Now, an equipment hatch is the big hole that they have in the side of the containment to move large pieces of equipment in and out during outages. And it's bolted with many, many bolts. And the equipment hatch is completely dislodged and moved sideways. So, you know, the containment has no integrity. I'm not worried about a chain reaction occurring anymore. I think that, you know, when the nuclear fuel melts down into a blob, you can't have a chain reaction because there's not enough water to moderate it.
Mm.
But you know, long-term, and let me jump to all three units here, long-term, the radiation doses inside these containments are on the order of 7,000 rem per hour. Now, you know that 1,000 rem per hour will kill you in 15, 20, 30 minutes. And so we're talking about seven times that high. There's no technology available to remove the nuclear fuel from inside those containments. Even if it was robotic, the circuitry, the integrated circuits and all, would get destroyed by that high level of radiation. So the long-term future for what to do with Units 1, 2, and 3, the reactors, the melted-down reactors, I don't think there's a person on the planet who'll tell you today how to get that nuclear fuel out. And we may do a Chernobyl. We may say, well, we'll remove the building as best we can, but oh, that nuclear fuel in the basement, we're just going to fill it with concrete and walk away. About 10 years out, it'll be cool enough that in theory they could put concrete in those basements and just entomb them as like a mausoleum.
Now, so what you said then is that Unit 3, the building, because it may have been an excursion, in fact, a nuclear explosion that occurred in that spent fuel pool, is very, very damaged compared to Units 1 and 2, and probably the building is as damaged as Unit 4. Therefore, it too could collapse if there is an earthquake greater than 7. Is that what you're implying, Arnie?
Yes, both Unit 3 and Unit 4 are jeopardized because of an earthquake. Unit 4 is probably a little stronger, but has an awful lot more nuclear fuel in it.
Yeah.
Unit 3 is probably a little weaker, but has a little bit less fuel. But they're both potentially dangerous, and either one is going to make a very bad day for Japan. It doesn't take both of them to collapse to basically cause the collapse of a nation.
Well, and also that what needs to be remembered is if either of those collapse and go and huge amounts of radiation are released as a consequence, the whole site will have to be evacuated. In other words, no workers can stay there to keep everything stable, so other things could occur sequentially, correct?
Yeah, we had that almost happen here in the United States. There's a reactor near Chicago called Dresden, and Unit 1 had been shut down and someone turned the heat off, and the fuel pool piping began to freeze and break. And the calculations show that if the leak had gone on for another day, the fuel would have been exposed, which is, you know, the water does two things. It cools, but it also acts as a shield. So the fuel would have been exposed, and you couldn't get within 100 meters of the building. So, of course, Fukushima has more radiation because there's a lot more fuel. So the you wind up with a no-go zone that would go out 200 or 300 meters. So if you can't get within a couple hundred meters of Unit 4, that means you can't get into Unit 3. And if you can't get into Unit 3, it's going to suffer the same problem. So the risk is that the direct radiation, called sky shine, if the pool were to drain, the radiation would go up and bounce off the air molecules with something called Compton scattering, and come down on the site and prohibit human beings from getting anywhere near the reactor to do any work or to try to recover from an event like that. It's really serious. I keep telling people that.
Would that be for the four reactors there, that if anything happened at Unit 3 or 4 to produce the sky shine, the Compton effect, that the whole site would have to be evacuated then?
The worst case is a domino theory like that, where Unit 4 would take out Unit 3, would take out Unit 2, would take out Unit 1. This is remote, but certainly plausible.
Okay, so let's go to Unit 2 now, which had the MOX fuel in it. I think 7% of the fuel rods were plutonium and uranium mixed fuel. What's happening at Unit 2 now, Arnie? Would you like to describe that situation?
Yeah. Actually, Unit 3 is the one that had the MOX fuel.
Oh, it's Unit 3?
Yes.
That means when there was an excursion in the cooling spent fuel pool, plutonium would have escaped as that explosion occurred, correct? Well, a lot of plutonium. Would that be correct?
Well, there was Unit 3 only had 30 bundles of MOX.
Oh.
But, you know, it's not about the new fuel they're putting in, which we call MOX.
Yeah.
But all of these reactors will develop plutonium.
Yeah.
As the fuel burns, as uranium-235 burns,
yeah,
there's a lot of more uranium-238, and it becomes plutonium. So the spent fuel transmutes from uranium into plutonium. So there's about, as a matter of fact, right before a nuclear reactor shuts down, every outage, so after every 18 months when a reactor shuts down, about 10% of its heat comes from plutonium being fissioned.
Really?
So yes, they all have plutonium in them. They didn't start that way. They all started with uranium-235 and uranium-238.
Yeah.
But once you get the chain reaction going, the 238 transmutes into plutonium anyway.
And the plutonium.
So the plutonium
fissions.
Issue is real, whether or not we have MOX fuel.
Yeah. Well, I know that each reactor makes about 500 pounds of plutonium a year, and you only need 10 pounds to make yourself a nuclear weapon, A, and B, it's so toxic that a millionth of a gram almost certainly is carcinogenic, and C, plutonium has a half-life of 24,400 years, so it's around virtually forever. So apart from that, it's a really nice material.
You're absolutely right. All of that is true. So when people were concerned about, Unit 3 has MOX fuel, if it had been an entire MOX core, it would be a different story because it's much harder to control an entire MOX core. But they were just experimenting with the possibility of having a MOX core, so they only had 30 bundles in Unit 3.
How do you mean it's much harder to control a MOX core? Explain what you mean by that, Arnie Gunderson.
Well, there are things called prompt neutrons and delayed neutrons, and you control a nuclear reaction based on the delayed neutrons that are released from a fission. And uranium releases quite a few delayed neutrons, so it's easier to control a uranium reaction. Plutonium releases much fewer delayed neutrons, so it's harder to keep the reaction under control with a plutonium reaction than it is with uranium, which is why, of course, we don't use plutonium.
Oh, my God. So you mean you can have a meltdown much more easily with a MOX core than you can with a uranium core?
You could have a prompt criticality much easier, which is even
a prompt criticality. You mean a nuclear explosion?
A chain reaction that gets out of control.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about Unit 2 then. We need to get on to that.
Well, Unit 2, they thought there was going to be 5 meters of water inside Unit 2, which was about 16, 17 feet. And when they finally ran a tiny piece of fiber optic cable in with a camera on it, they didn't find the water, and they went down, they went down, they went down. Finally, they found the water at 60 centimeters, or about 2 feet of water at the bottom. So where they thought they had 17 feet of water, they only have 2 feet of water.
Oh, my God.
And again, it gets back to think of a plastic soda bottle that's been shot at with birdshot. There's an awful lot of holes in it, and it's leaking everywhere. So what engineers had hoped to do to empty the nuclear fuel from the reactor was to fill the containment. And if they could fill the containment
with water,
they could then get inside, because the water would act as a shield.
Mm.
But these containments are so damaged that to use water to fill them is not going to happen. Those high dose rates I told you about were measured in Unit 2.
Mm.
And actually, Unit 2 is likely better than either 1 or 3. So if we've seen lethal doses, 10-minute lethal doses inside Unit 2, it's likely the problem is even worse in Unit 1 and Unit 4, and Unit 3, rather.
Okay, now let's go to
It's stable,
yeah.
And it's leaking like a sieve into surrounding buildings, which are in turn leaking into the ocean.
So they're continually pouring seawater into Unit 2?
Well, they stopped using seawater.
Oh.
They have these filters by Areva and another company whose name escapes me, and they're taking the water out of the basement, filtering it, and pumping that filtered water back into the nuclear reactor. In the process, though, I don't know if you've seen the aerial pictures of the site, they're building up this huge football field full of these filters that are highly, highly contaminated. And we're only about 9 months into using the filter, so this process has to go on for years, and they're rapidly running out of space for all these filters. But the goal was not to use seawater, because it's very, very corrosive, and not to use any additional water, because they frankly don't know what to do with all the water they've got. They're finding, though, that the groundwater is leaking into these basements as well as leaking out, and so they're putting in tons of groundwater is leaking in every day. And eventually they'll run out of tank space on site and likely have to dump some of that in the ocean.
Okay, so now Unit 1.
Unit 1, it was the first to blow up and the first to melt down, but it also was the first to get that tent put over the top of it. So it's not releasing any gases anymore. The gases are all trapped in the tent, and then they're treated, and some of them go up a stack, like the krypton 85 and things like that. But some of the other ones are trapped in filters that don't go airborne. So the day-to-day airborne releases from Unit 1, I guess I'd say, are under control. The same problem on the liquids, though, that the reactors are leaking into spaces that no one ever thought they would leak into, which in turn are causing contamination of both the ocean and the groundwater. But Unit 1 is everyone in the short term presents the least problems of any of them.
Well, Arnie Gundersen, I read that hydrogen is still building up in units 2 and 3, which could trigger another hydrogen explosion. So they're injecting nitrogen gas into the units to dilute the hydrogen so there won't be an explosion. Is that still true?
Yes. I did a video on this a couple months ago where I deflagrate a bottle full of hydrogen gas. And slowly, over the last couple of weeks, the hydrogen has continued to build up inside these containments. It's not coming from fission, and it's not coming from a Zircaloy water reactor. It's coming from the bombardment of water from all the radiation that's in the core. So a radioactive particle hits H2O and splits it to crank out the hydrogen. And it's up now. It was incredibly low, and now it's up to about 0.5% hydrogen. So the trend is worrisome. It has to get to 4%, though, so it's about 0.5 to 0.6% hydrogen. It has to get to 4% before it will explode. So there's still a margin to prevent an explosion. But the trend that why is the hydrogen going up is worrisome. The nitrogen doesn't dilute the hydrogen so much as displace oxygen. If you pure hydrogen won't burn. You know, if you were inside the Hindenburg and lit a match, the match would go out because it was pure hydrogen. It's only when hydrogen comes in contact with oxygen that it burns. Yeah. So Tokyo Electric is pumping nitrogen gas, excess amounts of nitrogen gas, into each of the containments in order to force out the oxygen to make sure that there's no potential for explosion.
See. Okay, now the next major question, Arnie, is how much radiation is being released daily from this whole complex, both into the air and into the water, A, and B, what are the isotopes that are being released into the air and into the water?
I would say there are billions of becquerels per day, actually trillions of becquerels per day, being released airborne. But I really don't know the isotopic concentration, mainly from Units 2 and Unit 3. They were the most contaminated. And actually, on cold nights, you can still see the steam coming off those reactors. Well, it's not just steam. It's radioactive steam. So something on the order of trillions of becquerels per day.
Tell people what a becquerel is.
A becquerel is a disintegration per second. So trillions of disintegrations per second per day are being released even now. Compared to the peak of the accident, trillions of disintegrations is nowhere near as huge as what the peak of the accident was. You know, we still see, though, periodic spikes in Tokyo. And I don't think that's coming from airborne releases. I think that's coming from windy days that are throwing the dirt up between Tokyo and the reactor site. You know, because there's a lot of contamination on the ground. If you look at some of the detectors in downtown Tokyo, every once in a while, one will be 4 or 5 or 6 times higher than it had been the previous day. And I attribute that not to direct releases from the plant. I think the plant is going to release pretty much a steady amount. But if there's high winds between the plant and the and Tokyo, you'll see these spikes, mainly of cesium-137 and 134. So that sort of touches on the airborne. The waterborne is still my biggest concern. You know, Woods Hole has already said that Fukushima has released more than 10 times more radiation into the water than did Chernobyl. And of course, Chernobyl is 30 years on, and Fukushima is only 1 year on. So
clearly the ocean contamination from Fukushima is greater than anything we've ever experienced before. They're talking about building sort of a dike right along the water, made of steel that they would drive into the ground, and that would go down to bedrock, because the groundwater is so saturated with radioactive material that it's seeping out into the ocean. But a lot of radiation got blown into the ocean already, and you know, talk about plutonium. I believe that the explosions we saw in units one and especially unit three introduced fuel fragments into the ocean, and so you know, we run the high likelihood of things beyond what you know, the cesiums and the strontiums. We wind up with the likelihood of seeing those heavy materials like plutonium that have also entered the ocean.
So what you're really saying, Arnie Gunderson, is that the ocean will be continued to be contaminated kind of for the rest of time, because there's no foreseeable way that they can actually prevent the water leaking out of the sieve-like containment vessels continuously into the ocean. They might build a dike, but probably that won't work. So we're talking about continual contamination of the Pacific Ocean. And then
you're right.
I'd like you to extrapolate, please, to the fish being caught on the west coast of Canada and the United States, and the ocean currents from Fukushima hitting the west coast of the United States. When do you think fish will be arriving that are radioactive? A, B, when do you think currents carrying contaminated water will be hitting the west coast, and what's your prognosis for this?
Well, there's a that's a major concern. The State Department and the Japanese government have made an agreement that says that we won't monitor the material that's being shipped from Japan. And I like to call that the don't ask, don't tell policy.
You mean food?
Yes, for food, yes. The Japanese are not telling us what's in the food, and we're not asking what's in the food.
Oh, my God.
It's interesting because that was signed by Hillary Clinton almost a year ago now.
Yep.
And when I was an expert on the Indian Point hearings, Hillary Clinton was a senator, and she was threatening hearings because of a tritium leak at Indian Point. But here we've got a triple nuclear meltdown at Fukushima, and she's saying that we don't need to worry about the contamination. So I think we definitely have a two-faced attitude toward contamination. I think my concern is not so much the currents, but the migratory fish.
Mm.
I think we're going to see the top of the food chain fish, the salmon and barracuda or the tuna start to become more and more radioactive over the next couple of years. We're already seeing, in Japan, we're already seeing freshwater fish, from the mountain streams. Well, the cesium that was in the mountain soil is now running into the mountain streams, and it collects in river sediment, and fish eat the things that live on the river sediment, so it builds its way up the food chain. Similarly, in the ocean, we're seeing lots of cesium contamination in the ocean sediment, relatively near Fukushima, a 200-mile radius, it seems. So that, but those fish in those areas are also contaminated, and the fish that eat on them are more contaminated. So we are seeing the cesium working its way up the food chain, and it's only a matter of time where tuna or something like that will get transported into the United States and be contaminated. It has to happen. That's just the way bioaccumulation occurs.
And is the EPA testing the fish that are caught in the Pacific Ocean, A, and are they testing the air at this time? Should there be another accident? Are they testing anything at the moment, Arnie?
No, there's no federal government testing going on. You know, if your listeners could do something, the one thing I think we can do is to get West Coast governors in the United States, and you know, along the Pacific Rim, government officials interested in sampling seafood. I've been working with individuals in Washington, Vancouver, Oregon, and California. To try to get their local officials, their state officials, to do some monitoring. It would be useful information, but I think there's a lot of pressure from the federal government not to measure the radiation.
Now, okay, to change the subject completely, Jani Gunderson, can you give us a brief rundown of what's happening in San Onofre, those two reactors there on the West Coast in California, both built near near earthquake faults?
I'm working for Friends of the Earth on the San Onofre problem. What happened was that San Onofre was built by Combustion Engineering about 30 years ago. And the steam generators, which are huge, 700-ton pieces of equipment, lasted about 30 years and were replaced. Well, the new steam generators failed in 10 months. They were made by Mitsubishi Heavy Industries in Japan. And what I've been able to determine is that Mitsubishi has never made a steam generator of this design. They had always made Westinghouse generators, and they had never made combustion generators. So all of the codes that they used, all of the computer modeling they used, really wasn't benchmarked to analyze the combustion design. What happened was that the net effect of that was that the top of the steam generator basically ran dry, and the tubes were allowed to collide with each other. And one, they damaged each other, and two, they got pinhole leaks. Separately, there's plates that keep them separate, keep the tubes separate. So they've worn by rubbing next to the plate. If they didn't collide into each other, they wore by rubbing against these plates. So the net effect is that you know that Beach Boys song "Good Vibrations." Well, there's no good vibrations at San Onofre. It's likely the plant will never see 100% power again. When they hit 100% power, the tubes will continue to rattle and will damage more tubes near them. So even if they plugged the tubes that are the worst case tubes, the rattling from the plugged tubes will be perpetuated, and it will damage additional tubes. So I think the best case for San Onofre, the owner, for Southern California Edison, is that they may run it at half power for years to come. That's probably the likely alternative for the operator. My opinion, personally, is that they don't know enough about the thermal hydraulic performance inside that generator and really shouldn't let it run until they've replaced it. So I think they should spend another $800 million and go and do it right this time. And until the steam generators are replaced, the units should stay shut down.
Is it $800 million per steam generator? Or because I know...
No, it's 800 for the four steam generators at both units.
And how likely?
Now that was paid for by the ratepayers of California.
Of course.
And you know, if you bought a car and it didn't run after 10 months, I think you're entitled to your money back.
So, is there a possibility that the reactors couldn't stay permanently closed now, Arnie Gunderson?
In my opinion, they should stay permanently closed. But you have to remember, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is not likely to do that. Southern California Edison is suggesting they would run them at half power. I suspect that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will allow that to occur because they've never not allowed it to occur.
Well, if you lived near there, would you be worried that if it was they were both run at half power now? What is the danger potentially to the public there? And there are a lot of people living, I think about 7 million living within about 50 miles of those two reactors.
My biggest concern, the two worst sites in the country, in the United States, for nuclear power plants to be located are Indian Point, which is only 26 miles from New York City, and San Onofre, because it's, 45 miles from the suburbs of L.A. So the concern at Indian Point and at San Onofre is emergency planning. If there's an accident, you've got to move, like you said, 8 million people to get out of harm's way. And I just don't know how to even imagine
that's
that
impossible.
Occurring.
You can't do that. Let's...
When I was out there last week, and when the plant was built, this little town of San Clemente had 20,000 people in it, and now it's got 70. So over 40 years, the population has quadrupled. So that whole portion of Southern California 40 years ago was nowhere near as populated as it is now. So, you would think that the regulator would say, I'm not going to give you a license to continue to operate. And they're suggesting, Southern California Edison is suggesting that they'd like to get another 20-year license extension. But the you would think the regulator said, no, a deal's a deal. We had a 40-year deal. In 2022, it's time to shut down because the population density has just grown so dramatically. But instead, I suspect that the regulator will try its darndest to get the to find an excuse to keep the plant running for another 20 years.
Well, okay, Arnie, you've been an insider. I know for many years you thought I was a little bit of a nut being an anti-nuclear person, but now you've come around to realize that what I was saying over those years was accurate. But give us an insight into how on earth 7 or 8 million people living within 45 miles of San Onofre can force the shutdown of those reactors permanently. How can they do it? Tell us, Arnie, how can they do it?
You're not going to do it at a federal level. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is not going to be a regulator and to look at the fact that, oh, my God, the demographics have changed and we really should not allow this plant to run. The best opportunities are at the state level.
Mm-hmm.
I was out in California last week, and I spoke to two city councils, Irvine, which has 300,000 people, voted to send a letter to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, basically discussing just that. You know, we want you to do your job. And similarly, a second, somewhat smaller town, but, when 300,000 people raise up through their elected representatives and send a unanimous letter to the NRC saying, for God's sake, do your job, that's a strong sign. So I think that individuals acting at the state level through their towns and then the towns are talking, of course, to their senators, Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein. The pressure's got to come from the bottom up because to apply it at the top down is just not effective.
One last point to make, Arnie, in question is, why the hell is the NRC the sole responsible agency for, quotes, safety? Therefore, the state of Vermont can't close down Vermont Yankee on the grounds that it's worried about the safety to its citizens if it melts down, that the only organization that has the authority to do that on the grounds of safety is the NRC. I mean, I can't understand that, Andy Gunderson.
What happened, I think a federal judge misinterpreted the law.
Oh.
The Supreme Court says that the NRC has safety jurisdiction, but all other jurisdiction remain with the state. So a state like Vermont clearly has the right to shut a plant down for other than safety concerns. Well, this federal judge determined that we were using a secret code, and the secret code is when Vermont talked about reliability, we didn't mean reliability, we meant safety. So even though our law says reliability, we were secretly talking about safety. And based on his interpretation of our secret code, he decided that the unit should continue to operate. There's a lot of precedent in law that says judges can't look for secret codes in law. They have to look at what the words say. So I hope the judge will get overturned in the future.
Well, it's going to the Supreme Court, and I wouldn't trust that Supreme Court as far as I could kick it.
But it's interesting, Helen. It's a states' rights issue. And this Supreme Court is very much in favor of states' rights. So it's not clear that big corporations will win in a states' rights argument.
That's very interesting. Well, look, Arnie, once again, it's been the most fascinating, far-ranging, far-reaching conversation about which I think all our viewers will be intensely interested. And I think that you're going to just be a regular interviewee because on this program, because into the far future, that Fukushima situation will continue to exist and threaten the lives of millions of people. And there are, as you pointed out, reactors certainly within the United States that could threaten the lives of millions. And you're one person who really understands this situation in depth. You're our diagnostician and our prognosticator for all things nuclear. And I thank you very much, Arnie Gunderson, for this interview today.
Well, thank you for having me. And if any of your listeners are in Rome, I'll be giving a speech on May 21st at Teatro India in Rome about nuclear power. So maybe I'll get to meet some of them.
That would be wonderful. I wish I could be in Rome. Okay.
Well, thank you for having me, Helen.
Thanks, Arnie. Bye-bye. My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Arnie Gunderson, an energy advisor with over 30 years of nuclear power engineering experience in the United States. Please tune in again next week for another fascinating discussion. Please follow us. And if you want to support us, we'd be eminently grateful. You can go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org, where there is a donate button. I would greatly appreciate that. Thanks for listening today. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.